From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. Struggle for freedom, the greatest battle we will ever fight is the one against ourselves. Ever finding new means of self-improvement, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. While far from everyone will understand the Hebrew language, especially those of us who are not Jewish, most of us will be familiar with the Hebrew greeting, Shalom. Typically, if you know no other single word in that language, you will know Shalom. In fact, by one account, granted it may only be apocryphal, the first words spoken by civilized man in the New World were, Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you. Once Christopher Columbus landed, after having set sail westward, first expecting to find a back route to the Orient, Columbus simply presumed that any exotic peoples he encountered would necessarily be the lost tribes of Israel, and thus speak Hebrew, or some language closely related to it. Needless to say, the Indians did not understand. And yes, while Shalom is typically translated as peace, and correctly so, the word embodies a much larger concept. In addition to peace, as we know it in English, shalom entails many elements that come together in describing a certain state of being, such elements as safety, comfort, health, tranquility. The way words are formed in Hebrew is very interesting, and it is the same in related languages such as Arabic or in the Amharic language spoken in Ethiopia. Each word will generally be based on a three-letter root that defines the general semantic meaning, and then depending on what vowels, prefixes, and suffixes are added to that root, more precise meanings are formed. So without getting too technical, I'll simply point out that semantically related words will have the same root, and thus while shalom as a noun means peace, safety, comfort, and tranquility, the same root is used to form the verb lahashalim, which means to finish. It can mean to come to terms with something or to accomplish something. Then again, you take the noun shalom and change one vowel so you get shalem. You get an adjective meaning whole, intact, perfect, total. So you can see that far more than merely peace is meant by the word. The blessing offered through the greeting shalom encompasses a sense of completeness, and an understanding that such a sense of completeness is necessary to one's well-being. Interestingly enough, the age-old greeting of shalom is quickly disappearing from usage, even among Hebrew speakers, and is more and more being replaced by the English colloquial terms hi and bye. But that's simply a reflection of the growing lack of completeness in people's lives today, all around the world. In times past, achieving a completeness in life was a value and a goal worthy of effort. In Roman times, an adult man was expected to possess a range of physical, intellectual, and moral virtues, such as physical strength and good health, discipline, level-headedness, and drive, being well-rounded in terms of education, whether such education was gained formally or not. He was to have a strong command of language and of rhetoric, to excel in sport of some kind, to be financially independent and be smart about his money, not to mention mastering such basic skills as writing and counting, and in his society he was to do all he could to gain and protect his reputation for courage, honesty, and just the general horse sense associated with manly virtue. All these and more were the elements needed to generate a sense of completeness, Yet there was and is certainly more to it, and it perhaps takes an act of discovery, trial and error, for any given individual to find what is lacking in his life and what he needs to make his life complete, and to find that sense of harmony and tranquility implied in the Hebrew word shalom, peace, for himself. And it might not always be the same for everyone. Sadly, what I notice today is a lack of completeness in modern life. In most instances, this manifests itself in somewhat subtle and arguably minor or negligible ways, but I think the overall effect is cumulative. And that as a result, people today, even those in the midst of material abundance, are becoming sadder and sadder. And why we will often encounter those who, on the one hand, are highly successful in a career and live a life of material abundance, but who, on the other hand, find life not to be fulfilling. I suppose this is whence cometh the old adage, money can't buy happiness. That phrase is a bit sloppy. Money buys lots of happiness, and it's hard to be happy without it. However, it is true that having money is only one element, and if some other value, be it tangible or abstract, is missing in a man's life, he will likely suffer from a lack of completeness.
See?
human life, under the European model, does not lend itself to completeness. Neither do its institutions encourage it, and this is seen in subtle ways in which people act. For instance, Scandinavians tend not to talk in complete sentences. I'm serious. Setting aside the rudeness of the matter for a moment, a Swede who stops you in the street to ask for the time or for directions will firstly not excuse himself or ask you kindly for your attention. He'll simply walk up to you and say, "What's the time?" Right out of the blue, and then typically not thank you when you tell him, but just walk away. Worse still, more and more often now, you will encounter people walking straight up to you and coldly ask, "Do you have a mobile telephone?" Simply expecting that you should let him use it. No please, no thank you. If you refuse, or do not even have one, you'll get a dirty look, but no more words will be said. Yes, even short conversations with strangers are left incomplete. This really struck home with me when I paid a visit to the city of Ottawa, Canada. I think it was the summer of 2007. Now, I do always say excuse me or I beg your pardon before asking a stranger a question. But the Scandinavian habit of not completing sentences suddenly hit me one night when I had to ask directions of someone in a shopping mall car park. I said to a young man, "Excuse me, 417? He looked at me a bit confused, at first not understanding the question, a question I thought was obvious. It took him a second before he asked me in turn, "Are you asking directions on how to get to Highway 417? I answered, "Yes, please," and I immediately felt embarrassed at simply having been so lazy in speech as only to have given a man a number, leaving it to him to fill in the blanks. The gentleman answered, "Head straight down Pinecrest till you get to the overpass," or something like that, and I thanked him for his help. Thinking of this incident now, so many years later, still embarrasses me somewhat, especially since I've often complained and even become a little bit curt with Swedes who do the very same thing. I'm sick of it, really. When I was working in a restaurant, very often a customer would wander into the kitchen and simply say to me, "Men's room?" without excusing himself and apparently missing the staff-only sign on the kitchen door. Of course, I know he was asking to find the men's room, but I played dumb and I said, "I beg your pardon?" He'd repeat, "Men's room." Then I would say, "No, sorry, this is the kitchen." 9 times out of 10, the customer would then give me a puzzled look for my apparent lack of understanding. Now, I was not a total jerk about it. I would invariably follow up and ask, "Are you looking for the men's room?" and then point him in the right direction. Now, on the other hand, it may look like I'm reading far too much into a simple pet peeve of my own. However, this is only one element in a large cumulative body of incompleteness that does indeed have a detrimental effect on human relationships and society in the long run. Those who grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture take for granted an entire ritual that both confers and respects the dignity of a fellow human being. Firstly, by excusing oneself before asking a stranger a question, you are acknowledging that the stranger's time is his own and that you realize that you are not automatically owed his attention. Then once you've conveyed that by means of begging his pardon, he then knows that you know that his time is his own and that you will understand and appreciate his generosity in giving you his attention and then in answering a question. This is further reinforced by you thanking him and not just walking off once you get the answer. Listeners in the United States have certainly asked strangers questions hundreds of times in their lives, so perhaps you never think of it in such terms. The way English-speaking peoples ask strangers questions constitute a short but complete discussion. A resolution occurs for both parties. Now, on the other hand, consider the Scandinavian who, without excusing himself, approaches a stranger and simply says, "Time," then walks away without another word. What message does that send? By not excusing himself, the Scandinavian is sending a message that his fellow man has no right to his own time and to be left alone to his own thoughts, but needs to answer to all and sundry who would demand his attention. Furthermore, by speaking in incomplete sentences, he is telling his fellow man that he's not worth the effort of expressing oneself clearly, and that the fellow man should be in the business of mind-reading, or anticipating the informational needs of any stranger who might ask. And then by simply walking away without thanking the stranger for his time and help, not only does it convey ingratitude, but also leaves the matter unresolved. There is not a clear sign or psychological marker that the discussion is over. Now, some of you might simply think that I'm far, far too sensitive and should not pick apart such minor irritants to so great an extent. But surely it is clear that compared to the well-mannered Anglo-Saxon approach, the Scandinavian approach is very abrupt. While it does reflect a cultural difference, and you have to make some account for that, I don't think it's merely arbitrary. Rather, it does have a psychological element to it, a real psychological element. After all, what is it that makes abruptness seem so, well, abrupt? It's the feeling that occurs in conjunction with a given interruption, the feeling that something is incomplete. The habit of not speaking in complete sentences is an annoyance, but more astounding are the apparently deliberate attempts to avoid completeness in life. Sweden today is very much a culture in which live-in paramours do not get married. Yet, oddly enough, they all want the legal benefits of marriage and will enter into all sorts of convoluted arrangements to enter into a so-called cohabitation agreement. Now, in my line of work, I've translated quite a few such written agreements. The terms are invariably as follows. There's a preamble that states that the two named people agree to live together without benefit of marriage, but then the subsequent articles confer onto the parties all the benefits of marriage. Why not just get married? These so-called cohabitants sign contracts together, buy houses or other property together, get joint bank accounts, take out loans together, and yes, even have children with each other, and are in every other way tied to each other for years and years. Yet they're not ready to get married? Of course, the tiresome pseudo-intellectuals claim that marriage as such is a throwback to patriarchal structures and is a bourgeois affectation. Well, that's what they feel about good manners as well. So there's no getting through to them. Then again, there may be others who either are not religious or don't want a church wedding, or even those who don't want a lavish civil wedding, but still, you can go down to the courthouse and be married in as little as 3 minutes. That's assuming they drag out the ceremony by reciting a poem or doing something like that. But no, they won't even do that. Then they even have illegitimate children together and still do not get married. Thus, their children are bastards. They come into the world already subject to a wholly unnecessary kind of incompleteness in their lives. Of course, such responsibility is a quality of adulthood, something else which we in Europe never, ever reach, not completely. There was a time when adulthood meant personal independence, not simply in the sense of being out from the rules of one's parents, but self-sufficiency, self-responsibility. And that never really happens to people under the European model, which is just a euphemism for the nanny state. Consider what happens when you turn 18 in a European country. Say you leave the house and you want to get your own flat. Well, you can get a subsidy, a housing subsidy from that, a benefit from the government paid by taxpayers. You want to go to school, continue, go to university? Well, tuition's already covered by the state. You can get grants and loans and automatic scholarships to support yourself. You don't really have to take responsibility for. The loans need to be paid back over a series of years, but if you haven't finished paying back by the time you're 65, it's written off. You don't really have to worry about it. So instead, maybe you don't go to university. Say you have children instead, married or not. You get money for having children. It doesn't matter how much money you have already, just the fact of you having children entitles you to benefits. And it's not a matter of paying just for families or helping families out who don't earn enough. Even the King of Sweden himself collected child benefit for each of his 3 children when they were under 18. He thought he was setting a good example. And of course, you don't have to worry about health insurance. Not really, that's already paid for you. And as a result, you're not used to paying for insurance for anything. Even things like life insurance is very rare in Sweden. I mean, until recently, the state paid to bury you, and if you as a surviving spouse didn't have enough money to live on, well, the state paid for that as well. You never had to take responsibility for yourself. Say instead you run a business. Well, you think you're just going to be a taxpayer in that case? No, you run a business. You can get subsidies for that. And what about savings? No, Swedes have no savings. It's very rare for Swedes to have savings. Firstly, they pay so much in tax that they can hardly save any money. And when you retire, the state pays for you anyway. You don't have to worry about it. In fact, the system isn't really made to encourage saving. If you save your money and not spend it and put it in the bank, you'll have to pay tax on any interest, whereas if you simply not keep a savings account and simply borrow money or pay with a credit card every time you want something, well, then you get to write the interest payments off on your taxes instead. Now, it's always argued that without such a wide-reaching universal sort of social system, paying of benefits and that there'd be people who don't have enough money and they'd be poor and left destitute. But that's just ridiculous. The whole system is universal. Even people with lots of money, no matter what position you are all in the same net. This universality means that nobody ever really becomes a self-reliant individual. The tax system itself makes conscientious objection hard. There was 1 year in which I personally had to pay 76% tax. It was absolutely ruining my life. Then people ask me, how can you live? How can anyone in this country live paying such onerous tax rates? Well, the answer is simple. They are all on welfare. Sure, the state says, yeah, we'll take all your money, and if you want it back to buy a house, pay your rent, you need help paying food, you need help paying your medicine, no, we'll put your kids in school. All these things you don't have to buy because, well, we took the money first and spent it for you. That's the idea. Now, I say 76% tax. Another Swede would say, well, it's not that high. My tax is only, only 35%. But that's, they don't understand that 35% of what they are paid, but then their employer has to pay another 35% in payroll taxes and other employer fees. As a self-employed person, I have to pay both the income tax on what I earn and then also pay that another 35% myself as I'm self-employed. I have to buy my own labor from the state. Now, you think this would drive a lot of people crazy, and it does, but it also buys a lot of patronage. I have a hard time finding anyone on the street, anyone outside of academic or media circles, who actually say they believe in socialism, social welfare. However, they'll say things like, oh, I don't like this system, but I get money for my kids, so I'm going to continue to vote for this policy. Or even retired people whose very life depends on money from the state, they're not going to vote against that system. Sure, they hate the taxes, but they love what they get for other people's money. Because since I refuse to be part of that system, how could I afford these high taxes? Well, I couldn't, and it was ruining my life. Now, once again, someone who wants to be a conscientious objector, not take any benefits in the state, and still pay 76% tax, well, how does he do it? Well, no, it's very difficult. It was actually ruining my life. But instead of jumping on board and being part of the system, I decided to jump out the other way and incorporated my business offshore. Therefore, I don't have to pay the high income tax anymore. But it means I get no benefits from the state, and I'm prepared for that. See, freedom is difficult. Adulthood is difficult. It's a lot to think about. There's a lot to do. And we in Europe are just not used to it. We're just not prepared for it. And it's something with which we're totally unfamiliar. That's why people don't understand when I go and I pay cash for everything, even things that are subsidized. I get this strange, incredulous look, sincerely incredulous look from people. I even get laughed at the drugstore if I have to buy prescription drugs with my own money, and I actually fork out the money. I don't take it for free. It's really strange what they do. If you need a kind of medicine that's subsidized, the pharmacist will bring it out, put it on the desk, and then put this big yellow sticker on saying paid for. But it's been paid for by the government. It's been paid for by taxpayers, not by the person using it himself. And so I always refuse that. I pay for it myself, and they just don't quite understand why I would do that. And I'm not going to argue with them. I don't know why they laugh at me. You see, we never really grow up. One pastime of the Swedish media, of the mainstream media, is doing everything they can to embarrass the United States of America. What I mean by that is that they will do everything to make the United States look bad in the eyes of Swedish people. And they will print all sorts of op-ed pieces and letters to the editor of people with their terrible experiences of having lived in the United States. One thing that's very common is the surprise and shock that new mothers find. Swedish women who've moved to the United States have children and find that they do not automatically get a whole bunch of money to support themselves and their children. They write back to the newspapers, and the newspapers print their pieces in which these women are going crazy in what they're saying. Like, oh, can you believe that the government of the United States doesn't take its responsibility for the mothers, and they don't give me any money at all? This is shocking, shocking, shocking. It's interesting how it works in Europe. The government takes all your money and expects very much to give it back to you, but only on its terms. It attaches a whole bunch of strings on you getting your own money back. So instead of, for instance, not taxing you and letting you save money and budget carefully so you have money to support your family when you have children, no, the government takes all that money and then says, oh, we'll give you the money back when you have children. But then the government has a bunch of rules and stipulations. The mother has to take so many months off work. The father has to take so many months off work. There are other terms and conditions. So you yourself can't decide. Say if one parent, say the father can earn a lot more money at his work and it's better if the mom stays at home for an entire period of maternity leave. Well, you won't get the money because that's not what the state wants. So if you save all your money, you could have any sort of family arrangement you want. But no, even that is dictated by the state. Now, of course, you can make any sort of arrangement of who stays home, but you don't get any money in that case. You want to save your money so you can put your child into an education at a school of your choice? Well, no, you can't do that. The money you were going to save to do that is taxed away, and the state will give it back to you, but you have to put your kid in one of their schools that has a curriculum that they decide and on terms that they decide, and teaching subjects that the government decides and avoids certain subjects that the government decides. You have no means to do otherwise. So when do we ever get a chance to grow up?
Some place that he'd rather be. Talking with David, who's still in the Navy, and probably will be for life. About life for a while. And the piano, it sounds like a carnival, and the microphone smells like a beer, and they sit at the bar and put bread in my jar and say, man, what are you doing here? Oh, la 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 di di da, la la.
How much different would the world be today if people simply did what they knew was right and refrained from doing the wrong things? Even honest mistakes would be insignificant, and even minor slip-ups wouldn't be so significant. Generally, people who do the wrong thing know it's wrong when they do it, but they do it anyway. Is it just a matter of irresponsibility? Is it mental laziness? Is it dishonesty? Well, look, what's more common today, self-discipline or victimhood? I'm talking about discipline. Think about the responsibility one needs to take for his own health. Talk about people in the West getting sicker and sicker. We have obesity and diabetes and that. Well, what message are we getting? Yes, in fairness, some people are saying, yes, we have to change our ways. But there's also this medical conspiracy theory out there, or cynical explanations considering big pharma, big agra, all these people supposedly out there who want to make people sick so they can earn more money in their professions. Now, these cynical theories appeal to people because it helps you avoid responsibility. If you never exercise and you eat poorly, well, it's the fault of the fast food restaurants because they make such greasy food? Or is it the fault of the manufacturers of televisions and sofas because they're just too comfortable and you can't resist? Well, I don't know what the explanations really are, but you always hear these sort of things that It's always someone else's fault. Why are cigarette manufacturers getting sued? There's clearly, and by law, these warnings. Aren't they disclaimers? Saying these cigarettes can kill you, these things are dangerous, these things give you cancer, and then you buy them anyway. I have yet to see someone go into a store, ask for a pack. Yeah, sure, give me a pack of cigarettes. He takes in his hand, looks at the label, and backs up. Oh, whoa, wait a minute. These things are dangerous. Hey, put them back. I don't want them. I've never seen that. But isn't it a disclaimer? Why are we suing them? Why don't you just take responsibility for the fact that if you smoke, you can get sick, and you decided to anyway? And then there's, of course, financial problems, debts. Yeah, there is a message being put out there that, oh, we can have everything, and the credit card companies and all that make it all look like it's so easy to have everything now and pay later, and sure, but you can only blame them so much. The fact is, they're simply offering something that we want, and we don't think of what we really need, and if it's within our means. So all this crying about debts, and yes, even this whole mortgage crisis a few years ago and that, there's people who should have known that they themselves could not afford things. They're as much to blame as any of the banks or any of the policies or any of this. You're all part of the same failure, and you need to own up to it. Not everybody got ruined. Why is it some people did and some people didn't? Is it just by chance that the responsible people, they were just luckier or something like that? You're listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, kindly send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. Many of you will be aware of the very odd story out of New York some time ago. In fact, I'm sure you're all far more aware of it than I am, as I've not followed the story. But I recall not long ago some insipid business about the authorities in New York, I think just New York City, attempting to place a legal ban on soft drinks of a certain large size. This was supposedly in order to combat obesity and other such widespread conditions of poor health resulting from overconsumption and poor diet. Apparently, the regulation was struck down by the courts, naturally, but the authorities actually had the temerity to appeal the ruling. Apparently, it was such a pressing issue, I don't know what came of it in the end. About 10 years ago in London, there was a serious talk about wrapping all the lampposts and street sign uprights in the city with a kind of foam rubber padding. The reason was to prevent injury to all those who are in the habit of walking down the street while texting on a mobile telephone and who end up injuring themselves, as they, in their distraction, end up banging their heads on lampposts. I find that this has actually been tested on a small scale in London. Notice how the battles we are told we need to fight are always outside of us. If we lack some element of completeness in our lives, it's always due to some external factor, never to ourselves. Thus, if we are fat or sick due to drinking too many sugary soft drinks, it must be because the size of the serving is too great, and by simply passing a law limiting the serving size, everything else being equal, the problem will be solved. Now, I don't think anyone truly believes that limiting the size of a soft drink serving will put an end to obesity and poor health. But it's appealing nevertheless because it allows fat people to blame someone else for their poor health and to evade responsibility. Why not simply suggest that people cut down on consumption, regardless of the serving sizes in which such drinks are made available? I would say that if you like Pepsi, go ahead and have one. Have a big one, but just once in a while, as a treat. I don't think it was ever meant to be drunk like water every single day. However, that would demand a great deal of self-discipline and responsibility, two things characteristic of adulthood, the very concept with which we are becoming less and less familiar. How many times does someone need to bang his head on a lamppost while walking up Charing Cross Road before he learns not to walk and text at the same time, or at least to pay attention? If you've done it once, well, all right, these things happen. Twice, then we're entering into moron territory. But if it happens even more often, then perhaps you yourself should be the one to wrap some padding around your own head, or maybe put on one of those leather helmets that boxers wear when training. But that too would entail taking responsibility and making an effort in overcoming a failing in oneself. And that's not the message we get today. Our battles are with factors outside of ourselves. If you're in the habit of banging your head on lampposts, then that does not mean you're clumsy. It's the fault of the system in not having the foresight to wrap padding around the lampposts. What do kids learn in school today? What are the greatest battles which they need to fight? They need to fight things like climate change, corporate greed, discrimination, Islamophobia, white privilege, big tobacco, hate speech, patriarchy. And when you find kids have spent all day learning about such things and have not had time to learn reading, writing, or arithmetic, and thus fail in such endeavors, the solution is not to work harder on these or to devote more time to these studies. No, the solution is to lower the standards. The problem is the system, not oneself. Yes, there are cases where the system is the problem, as I've often complained on this program. If you live in North Korea or Cuba, if your very life and freedom are so precarious that you can be deprived of them by the powers that be on a moment's notice, then yes, your greatest battle is indeed with the system. However, even short of that, in other countries, there are many times when the system is the problem. The system is a problem when, by means of that system initiating the use of force, it stands in the way of you working toward your own self-fulfillment and greater completeness in your life. The system's a problem when it forcibly takes most of your earnings and decides to spend them for you. The system's a problem when it kidnaps you as a child and forcibly subjects you to its own indoctrination, regardless of your wishes or concerns or those of your parents. The system's a problem when it would fine or imprison a man for speaking his mind on air. Still, even in these cases, different people will go about fighting it in different ways. Some people will go about attempting to change the system, while others will try to work around it. If you feel crushed by your country's onerous income tax rate and you resent having your money confiscated in order to be directly redistributed to others who have not earned it, do you join a tax protest, write letters to congressmen or parliamentarians, and simply hope and wait for a change? Or do you start a business of your own and incorporate it offshore? If you don't like the way your children are being educated in state-run schools, do you complain to headmasters and to the PTA and Ministry of Education, or do you give more and better instruction to your child at home after school? Can't get a word in edgewise in the mainstream media and you're afraid of legal reprisals for touching on controversial topics on air? Do you picket the FCC or lobby to strike down legislation limiting freedom of expression? Or do you go to WBCQ? Now, that's not to say that all battles outside of oneself are not legitimate and important. Many are. But those that are ultimately successful still only correct a wrong that existed outside oneself. It does not offer a greater sense of completeness in one's own life. It's hard to escape the fact that those engaged in changing the system may be drawn by the opportunity for preening. If you are successful in a campaign to ban tobacco, you'll get a lot of attention and praise from a large number of people waiting to inflate your ego. You'll have nobody to thank you if you simply quit smoking. However, in an attempt to improve your own health and thus increase the completeness in your own life, surely the latter would be the path of least resistance and more wholesome for you in the long run. Her room, isn't it good? Norwegian wood. more, you are listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. On the one hand, we may have a burning issue close to our hearts and a passionate desire to make a change in the system in which we live, and then actively and loudly champion our causes. But on the other hand, at the same time, we may consciously understand that we have personal vices and failings, but not the discipline required to overcome them. This is why the greatest battle we will ever fight is the one against ourselves, and winning such battles is often the greatest service we can pay to our fellow man. How much better off would our communities be, even with the given system being what it is, if people generally exercised good manners, were modest in speech and behavior, honest in their business dealings, they showed up to work in time, were courteous drivers, could write legibly, could add two numbers together without an electronic calculator, were slender and in good health, they dressed respectably, paid their bills in time, and lived within their means. These are all things that one must take upon himself to improve. It might not always be easy, but the reward, the greater sense of completeness in one's life, is worth the effort. So next time you hear the greeting Shalom, keep in mind everything that word entails, and be grateful, for he who has such completeness in his life is truly blessed. Thank you for joining me this week, the first program of the autumn season of VSI Radio International. The program continues through the autumn each Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, here on 7,490 kHz. So until next week, this is Paul Lambert, wishing you all the best.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.